Hello, and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Liz, and in this 89th episode, I speak with Dr. Aaron LeBlanc all about the development of teeth in plant-eating reptiles. I've known Aaron for a couple of years now, first meeting when I was an undergraduate, and he was a master's student at the University of Alberta. Now that we're both doctors, and he's managed to get a postdoctoral fellowship back at the U of A, we met up to talk about why teeth are so interesting and just how variable dental systems can be. I certainly had no idea how much diversity exists, not just in the teeth, but in the whole system in general in herbivores. I found it fascinating, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Today at the University of Alberta, where I did my undergrad, and today I'm talking with Dr. Aaron LeBlanc. So before we get going, can you introduce yourself and kind of tell us how you got here, the U of A?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, welcome back to Canada, and foremost. So I actually grew up in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, which is the, you know, it's the University of Alberta is here, so I haven't moved very far from my birthplace. But I did my undergraduate degree here at the University of Alberta in paleontology. Mm-hmm. I did my master's here with Professor Michael Caldwell. And then I went out to the University of Toronto, Mississauga campus to work with Professor Robert Rice for my PhD. Mm-hmm. And I was out there right up until from 2011 to 2016. And then I didn't learn my lesson and I came back to the University of Alberta.
Came back home.
Yeah, and I'm now the Killam postdoctoral fellow.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So most of the work you've done, or I guess maybe all of the work you've done, has been kind of tooth related. So the first question that I want to ask you is, why teeth? Mm-hmm. Why, like, what's so interesting about teeth for you?
Well, what isn't interesting about teeth? I mean, I'm going to be kind of making a sales pitch, I guess, for this. But I think they're probably one of the most charismatic parts of a vertebrate. I mean, if we think about it, we think of a big T-Rex or something like that. The most intimidating feature is always the big set of chompers. Mm. But for me, I think academically, being interested in teeth, it was sort of a background theme to my master's where I was working on mosasaurs, which are these giant marine lizards. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the features that I was looking at were dental features, but that really didn't come to the forefront for me in terms of my research until I started my PhD mm-hmm. at the University of Toronto. And there I became more interested in them from a tissue perspective because I realized I could really carve out a niche for myself in my research, sort of describing what's going on in terms of how teeth change evolutionarily from the earliest reptiles, the earliest amniotes, right up to mammals and dinosaurs and crocs. There's actually a lot of stuff that we can learn about them that we know very little about even now.
So how are teeth different from bone or scales?
That is a very good question. and it's easier to answer when you work on things like reptiles and mammals because the distinction is very clear. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that distinction gets very fuzzy if you look at more like earlier vertebrates mm-hmm. That have very tooth-like scales and jawbones, but you know maybe they don't have teeth or they're jawbones with very weird-looking teeth that sort of blend into the underlying jawbone or even in sharks. I mean, you look at shark scales, they look a lot like teeth on the skin. Hmm. But the way that I think most people have settled on to define a tooth and distinguish it from bone is actually the structure that makes teeth. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at them from a tissue level, teeth are made of things like dentine, which is sort of the living bulk of your teeth. Mm-hmm. It's the part that gives you the sensitivity to hot and cold in your teeth, and enamel. But the problem is a lot of early vertebrates have this tissue on other parts of their skeleton, their mm-hmm. dermal skeleton. So a lot of people have settled on this thing called a dental lamina, which is this structure that sits sort of on the outside of the skin that dips down into the jaws in most vertebrates. And that's the thing that will eventually make teeth. And it sort of decides where and when to make teeth on the jaws.
Okay.
And so that's been sort of a nice defining characteristic. But the nice thing with reptiles and mammals is that teeth and bone have diverged so far from each other at that stage that you can cut them open and say fairly certain that you're looking at a tooth versus bone. And so that's why with teeth, we can say in a mammal or a reptile that if they have dentine, if they have enamel, and some of the other tissues that I work on that anchor the teeth to the jaws, you can tell them apart pretty easily.
And you mentioned kind of cutting them open and looking at it. So what kind of data do you use when you're looking at the teeth and trying to understand how it evolved and these kind of things?
Yeah, this part makes museum collection managers cringe a little, but I'm very responsible with this. I do a lot of thin section work, and it's very different when you're looking at teeth of a modern animal versus a fossil. Because fossilized teeth are, of course, extremely hard. And so I borrow a technique really from geology where we take a specimen like a fossil dinosaur tooth, let's say. We encase it in a resin to stop it from crumbling or anything in the subsequent steps to stabilize it. We put it under vacuum when we apply resin so that the resin gets into all the little nooks and crannies. And then we cut it open with a specialized saw. In our case, here at the University of Alberta, and where I did a lot of my work for my PhD at the Royal Ontario Museum, we use a really special wafer blade saw. So it's got a really, really thin blade, spins very slowly, it's very accurate. And with that, we're able to cut these things open any which way that we want, and then glue them to a microscope slide, and then cut that and grind that down to the optical thickness that we need to see through it in the microscope. Yeah.
And can you see different things at like different orientations? Are there different orientations that are better to see specific features?
Yeah, absolutely. So this technique is very common for the study of bone. So a lot of research, especially in dinosaurs, it seems, where people will cut open the limb bones of a dinosaur and they'll look at sort of growth lines and figure out, you know, growth curves and physiology questions about dinosaurs. That's usually done at a standard plane of section, which is like a cross section, like perpendicular to the long axis of the bone. With teeth, there's no standardized section. And it really depends on the question you're asking. And you have to think about that before you section a tooth. I mean, if you're looking, let's say, at growth lines in teeth, because there are growth lines in teeth, you have to think about how a tooth grows. And the way that you're going to cut it is going to affect how many growth lines that you see.
Interesting. I hadn't actually thought about that before. And obviously, teeth are very important in terms of diet and like what things are eating. Are there a lot of differences between what you'd see in like a carnivorous versus a herbivorous versus an omnivorous animal tooth, other than just general shape, I guess? But
yeah, so like a lot of what I did, especially for my PhD, I'd make this really bad joke that I was the jack of all clades and master of none, because I spent a lot of time sectioning teeth of very distantly related groups. And I did that because I wanted to understand some of the evolutionary patterns across amniotes. So that's mammals and crocodiles, lizards, dinosaurs. And one of the patterns that you get from that is that herbivorous things tend to have, of course, more complicated teeth for pulverizing tough plant material. You know, carnivores will have bladed teeth, you know, serrated teeth, conical teeth for grabbing something and piercing their prey. Maybe they'll have crushing teeth, but there's a sort of a limited number of solutions to the problem of cutting meat. And with plants, there's it puts a serious functional demand on teeth to grind through something as tough as plant material. And so the common theme for herbivorous things is to have more complicated teeth, sort of anatomically from the outside, but also when you cut them open and look at them from a histology perspective, from a tissue perspective, like I do, they're quite complicated.
Interesting. I always just kind of thought that it was sort of a morphological external thing and, you know, didn't, I guess, never really thought that looking inside, it would also be different.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, from a functional view, I mean, you can imagine that if you're grinding a tooth down,
yeah,
you know, there's going to be a lot involved there. And there's a lot of adaptations in different kinds of animals to cope. And sometimes to encourage that tooth wear to happen in a certain way to help sort of maintain a nice complicated grinding surface. Yeah. A good example is in horses.
Yeah.
So a horse tooth, it's made of the same tissues as our teeth, let's say, you and I. It's just that they're arranged very differently. So they're sort of folded on top of each other and into these complex patterns that as they grind their teeth down, you know, horses expose these different tissues that are different, you know, hardnesses or wear differently. Mm-hmm. And that's going to help maintain a nice complicated grinding surface.
I see. A lot of the work you did in your PhD obviously was looking at herbivorous teeth and evolution. Are there ways that we can tell that an animal is herbivore other than their teeth? Or do you basically kind of look, this is a tooth of a herbivore, so I'm going to look at this tooth? Are there other features?
Yes, absolutely. I'm more interested in the tooth side, but there are definitely other features you could look for. One of the things with early amniotes, especially where Robert Rice's lab has been very interested in the origins of herbivory for a long time, and that's sort of how I got my start in doing tooth histology work. Yeah. He spent a lot of time thinking about sort of the anatomical features of an animal that tell you it's an herbivore, and some of them make a lot of sense. Yeah. So a good one would be like the big barrel-shaped trunks, the big barrel-shaped ribs and body outlines of some early herbivorous animals, because they are essentially, if you're an herbivore, you're a big fermentation chamber. Think like a cow, right? Like they're eating a lot of plant material. There's a lot of gases that build up. You need a lot of room for a lot of that extensive digestive system to chemically break down plant material. And so that tends to be a pretty good clue that you're looking at an herbivore before even looking at the teeth.
Yeah. Other than the fact that herbivores have interesting teeth, why were you most interested in looking at herbivores? So is this related to kind of, I guess, the evolution of the animals or what, like, why are herbivores interesting?
Why herbivores? I know, right? They're not the most charismatic things. I mean, I see reconstructions of late Cretaceous ecosystems, and I just feel like the herbivores are just the food for the carnivores.
Yeah.
That's just what the cool things eat. But they're obviously really important as a main sort of pathway for energy exchange between plant and animal communities or parts of a community. And I think the interest for me is kind of incidental.
Yeah.
When I started in Robert Rice's lab, the first thing I looked at were these things called diadectids. Mm-hmm. Diadectids were probably the earliest tetrapod herbivores. We're not even sure if they were true reptiles or amniotes, but they were somewhere close to that group. And they have really complex teeth, especially for their time. I mean, everything at that stage, this is sort of like around the 300 million year mark. Mm-hmm. So we're in the like late Carboniferous and into the early Permian periods. Sort of the trophic structure, the community structure at that time on land was pretty simple. Mm-hmm. A lot of plants and a lot of invertebrates eating the plants, but not a lot of vertebrates eating the plants. In fact, at that point, the main sort of energy exchange was, small carnivorous tetrapods eating the bugs, and then larger tetrapods would eat the smaller ones, and you'd kind of build up from there.
Yeah.
So diadectids were sort of these pioneers, these peace-loving pioneers, you know. I'll just eat the plants. And so that was interesting for me because these were like the first really complicated-looking teeth in a tetrapod.
Yeah.
You know, these were, they had these three kind of cusps on their grinding teeth, and they would clearly wear them down quite flat over time, and then they'd replace them with new ones. And so I was really interested in what their teeth looked like on the inside. Mm-hmm. That's what really started me on that herbivory angle. And then from there, it's completely incidental. I started working on these things called Captorinids, which are these early Permian reptiles. And they're really cool because they have multiple rows of teeth.
Yeah.
So really that's technically a dental battery.
Yeah.
That's what they had. Instead of it being stacked like a duck-billed dinosaur, we have these stacked and interlocked teeth that form this one, you know, giant looking tooth. They had sort of these multiple rows, and the upper and lower jaws would move past each other and grind up their food. And we think a lot of those guys were herbivores too.
Yeah.
And so here's another example of just a complicated looking dentition.
Yeah.
But it's related to herbivory again.
So going back to didactids, so herbivory evolved from carnivory so that's kind of the first sort of change in diet that we see, like, in the fossil record.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So diadectomorphs, so the more inclusive group that includes these herbivorous diadectids.
Yeah.
At the base of that group are a lot of carnivorous things.
Okay.
We know that, again, from the shapes of their teeth. They're very conical teeth, pointy, used for grabbing prey items. And so from there, one of these lineages diversifies into this completely empty niche where they can now exploit plant resources.
Yeah. You know?
And that was huge. The funny thing is, diadectids do it. A few other groups do it around the same time, maybe a bit later. But it doesn't really take hold really until, I would say, the middle Permian. So millions of years later, and then we start to see a shift to more large-bodied herbivorous things roaming around. And that's when we start to see that shift to more, modern-looking terrestrial communities where you have lots of herbivores, and then you have a fewer larger carnivores that are preying on, a big resource of herbivorous things.
With kind of those early herbivores, how did their teeth, you said that kind of inside they look quite different from the sort of similar carnivorous ones. How do they differ, and how does this relate to a herbivorous diet?
Mm-hmm. Well, this, my first venture into tooth histology in this case, I was looking to examine what tissues hold the teeth into the jaws. And that was a really important question for the homology of tooth tissues, because we knew nothing really about what fastens the teeth to the jaws in things that aren't mammals or crocodilians.
Yeah.
That sounds a bit weird, but there's this historical burden of, we knew a lot about mammals because of veterinary science and dentistry. We knew a lot about crocs, turns out, because they have the exact same arrangements of tissues that support their teeth and hold them in the jaws that we have. Hmm. And so to give you kind of a bit of a background why this is important, we have a very complicated system of tissues that support our teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not things made by the jaws. They're actually things made by the teeth themselves.
Interesting.
Yeah. So our teeth aren't fused to the jaws. They're not sort of like tent pegs that are hammered into the ground and rigidly held in place. They're more like the tarp that you hang over your tent. They're suspended in their tooth sockets by a ligament.
Yeah.
And this ligament gives our teeth a little bit of give.
Yeah.
And a cushioning force. So when you're chewing on your food, and that helps sort of diffuse and dissipate the forces of chewing.
Yeah.
Turns out crocodilians do this. And we could imagine they do that maybe because they bite really hard.
Yeah.
Beyond that, when you look at things like lizards, or other fossil reptiles, we thought everyone else fused their teeth to the jaws by this tissue, this one bony tissue everyone calls bone of attachment.
Yeah.
It's kind of a nice term for it. It's just this bone that's associated with each individual tooth that attaches it rigidly to the jaws.
Yeah.
And so I was interested. So what did diadectids do? Because in a way, they're not really chewing like a mammal, but these early herbivores were grinding.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to know, are they going to look more like mammals and crocs for that reason and have this ligament system that holds their teeth to the jaws? or are they going to be, you know, have this bone of attachment stuff?
Mm.
And so that was a question of histology.
Yeah.
That was a question of cutting the jaws open and looking. And we found overwhelming evidence that these things had a ligament system that held their teeth to the jaws, just like a mammal or a croc. Yeah. And these are 300 million years old.
Right? How many jaws did you have to cut up to figure that out?
Jaws, I had, to think off of memory, 4, maybe 5. Not complete.
Yeah.
Okay, so I should probably preface this and say I am merciful with my section. I don't look for these really pretty specimens to section. I understand the value of fossils to the fossil record.
Take the most amazing one possible. Yeah, that's the one.
I don't do that. So a lot of the times I'll get jaws where the teeth are broken.
Yeah.
Or I'll get partial jaws. And that's a lot of what I had to work with. But I also had isolated teeth.
Okay.
Those became really important. I didn't section these, but I also had a lot of jaws where all the teeth had fallen out in these diadectids. And I went and looked at some skulls, for example, at the Field Museum in Chicago of these herbivorous diadectids. And a lot of the times I noticed the teeth had fallen out of the jaws.
Yeah.
That's actually incredibly informative.
Yeah.
Because what that tells you is that these teeth aren't fused.
There's nothing to the sticking jaws. It.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what happens in modern mammals and crocs. Yeah. They die and the soft tissues decay. Well, there's soft tissue holding the teeth to the jaws. So they fall out too.
And how do things like captorhinids with their sort of dental battery, how does that fit into fusing ligaments? What kind of thing are they doing?
Yeah.
What are they doing?
So their teeth are fused to the jaws.
Okay.
Yeah. So it gets really confusing really fast. And I've sampled a lot of different things, not just these herbivorous things, but that story of fusing teeth to the jaws or having a ligament, it's incredibly complicated.
Hmm.
What captorhinids do, though, is because their teeth are fused to the jaws and they develop these multiple rows of teeth, they had to develop a system to move teeth across their jaws to make room for new rows, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So what captorhinids do, and I guess to visualize what they look like, it's, you know, they have a typical dentition at the front. They have just, you know, a single row of teeth at the front, and then the jaws just expand at the back, and they have these platforms that, you know, multiple rows of teeth will sit on. They're just kind of running parallel to each other. They can have 2 rows, they can have 5. I've heard of as many as 10 to 12 rows in some different captorhinids. And so because their teeth are fused to the jaws, in order to move them, they seem to have evolved a weird method of jaw growth. So the jaw bones themselves are actually kind of moving, in air quotes. The way that you can tell is by, again, thin sectioning them and looking at the bone and seeing what the bone is doing at the tissue level. And they remove a lot of bone on the outside of the jaws.
Yeah.
And they add a lot of new bone on the inside.
Weird.
Yeah. So as they're doing that, it creates the net effect is to create sort of like this slow sideways conveyor belt movement. So, And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even weirder in captorhinids is that it looks like it evolved at least twice.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how long ago were these animals living?
Captorhinids go back around the 300 million year mark, maybe a bit older.
Yeah.
The earliest ones are single tooth-rowed captorhinids from the late Carboniferous.
Yeah.
And then when you get into the early Permian period, about 290 million years ago, you see the first multiple-rowed captorhinids. And the best one is Captorhinus agouti. It's the species. It's sort of the poster child of captorhinids.
Yeah.
It's very, very common from this one cave infilling site, this fissure fill site in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
It's known from thousands of specimens.
Oh, wow.
Thousands and thousands. So that's why they're great for that section.
That was probably quite good for you.
Yeah, no one's going to miss a few, right? And so they're the first ones to really experiment with that.
Yeah.
And they're from a great site because it's also associated with a lot of single-rowed captorhinids as well, different species.
So you can look at the differences between the two side by side.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we did in a paper back in 2015. We were really interested in examining the jaw growth in single-rowed versus multiple-rowed captorhinids from this site. And then from there in the early Permian, a second group of capped rhinids shows up that does the same thing.
Yeah.
The multiple rows are organized a bit differently, but there's not a whole lot of major differences. And these ones actually grind them flat. Yeah, so there's some heavy, heavy tooth wear in the second group of capped rhinids. And those are the ones that we're pretty sure were herbivores.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with the ones that are grinding, how can you tell that they're grinding? How do you know that's what they're doing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. How do we know? We don't know anything for sure in paleontology. We can't watch them eat their food. But these capped rhinids are really great because there's so many, we can look at the different stages of tooth wear.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at, especially the second group of capped rhinids, they're called the Muratosaurians. We looked at a whole bunch of them from Oklahoma, and we could stick them under the SEM, the scanning electron microscope,
mm-hmm.
and we could zoom in on the wear patterns on their teeth. And they have really fine but parallel scratches on their teeth that run front to back on every one of their teeth, even the ones worn flat. And that kind of pattern is created as the teeth from the upper and lower jaws run past each other forward to back.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so we know that that's tooth wear.
Yeah.
And you can see that in lightly worn ones all the way to the heavily worn ones.
Have you looked at all at different ages, or are these just kind of older ones that you're looking at?
Like older individuals?
Yeah, sorry, or older individuals.
In the example with these herbivorous capped rhinids, we looked at a lot of them that were kind of around the same age class.
Yeah.
The problem is that the site that we looked at in this case, also from Oklahoma, also a cave infilling, but not the same cave infilling as the one that capped rhinus agouti is famously known from. The problem with this site is it's a lot of jaw fragments.
Okay.
And partial jaws. Some relatively complete ones, but they're all fairly small-bodied capped rhinids. They're about the size of, I don't know, a gray squirrel, something like that.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's
so,
not this kind of scale I was thinking at all.
Yeah, these are pretty small ones. They do get a lot larger in later Permian species, get a lot larger. Some of them have heads the size of manhole covers or bigger. But these small ones that I looked at, they're around the same age class. But what's cool is because they have multiple rows of teeth.
Yeah.
And because the ones on the inside of that jar are the youngest, and the ones on the outside are the oldest, just because of that sideways conveyor belt thing, you can see teeth at different stages of wear in the same individual.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah. So they're worn flat on the ones on the outside rows, and they're still fairly pristine on the inside.
Interesting.
Yeah.
This might not have been something that you looked at all, but do you have any kind of a sense of, other than the tooth wear over time, any sort of sense of how the jaw might have changed through ontogeny kind of thing? Like it would be really interesting in something that has these multiple tooth rows to look at, like, a young juvenile, and how many rows do they have versus later on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, the problem with that is our best model to understand that is this animal called Captorhinus agouti, again, that poster child of Captorhinids.
Yeah.
Because there's so many.
Yeah.
From this one locality. The problem with having so many is it turns out that there's no pattern between the number of tooth rows and how big the animal is.
Interesting.
So there we have small ones and we have big ones.
Yeah.
The problem is even the smallest ones can have, 3, 4, 5 rows of teeth. Same with the big ones. Some of them only have two. And they can be, some big ones only have one row. Some small ones only have one row. Some of them, the weirdest ones I've seen, just look like they have one row of teeth. And then you'll see one or two teeth right beside the normal tooth row.
Huh.
But this, and you can see that in small individuals and large ones.
Yeah.
It's a really confusing animal to look at from that perspective. And unfortunately, that's our best one because that one is known from so many specimens. I tried to section small ones and big ones to look for differences. Kind of hard to see because, like I said, even the small ones can have multiple rows already. Yeah.
And you definitely are sure these are the same species rather than being some weird small one that has a few rows versus a large one that only has one.
Mm-hmm. Oof, let's get into some species concept stuff. Whoa. Nope. Can't be 100% sure.
Yeah.
But the thing is, there are so many consistencies in the anatomy of the small and big ones.
Okay.
So Captorhinus agouti has a very characteristic tooth shape.
Okay.
We call it ogival. I had never heard of this term.
I've never heard
until of this term. I saw Captorhinids and learned what that looked like. How to describe this in audio only? The teeth, if you look at them head on, the teeth have this single crest made of enamel that runs front to back on each tooth. And the teeth aren't round if you look at them sort of from top down or, well, food's eye view, let's say. The crest runs front to back, and the teeth are sort of compressed.
Okay.
So they're longer than they are wide.
Yeah.
And that shape is very specific to Captorhinus agouti.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we have a single road animal that we've named Captorhinus magnus from that same locality that has a single row of teeth, and those teeth are the same shapes. So it's a complex problem.
Yeah.
And it's a complex problem because the fossil record of this group is really good.
Yeah.
And so, I could go on about species concepts, but because we have such a good record of them and because we don't just have two specimens.
Are you complaining that there are too many fossils of this one animal?
Well, I might be really badly paraphrasing Darwin here, but I'm pretty sure he said a taxonomist's worst nightmare would be a complete fossil record. And I think there's some truth to that, especially with Captorhinus, because, good luck delineating the two, honestly, because as I kind of mentioned earlier, you can get some that have one row of teeth and then one or two teeth sticking off to the side.
Yeah.
And then you can have one with another row. Yeah, you can have one with five rows. And the problem is we don't know if this really correlates well with size of the animal. It doesn't seem to. But that is a great project for somebody to come by and look at Captorhinus, you know.
And then you've also looked at kind of more recent, much later than Captorhinids with dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
So both, I guess, hadrosaurs and ceratopsians you've looked at. So how are they both have kind of a dental battery, but how are their batteries different?
Well, I guess I should probably describe the hadrosaur battery first because it's the one I've looked at the most and know the best.
Yeah.
And I think I've spent a lot of time looking at hadrosaur dental batteries. And I should point out that they are weird. They can consist of hundreds of teeth to make up this one dental battery on one side of the jaw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they consist of a vertical stack of teeth, maybe five, six or more even, I don't know, teeth tall.
Yeah.
And then several vertical stacks of teeth long, you know, something like, 20 to 30 stacks of teeth is not uncommon for a hadrosaur dental battery. So it's, hundreds of teeth. And I was really interested in them because people had touted how complex these things were.
Yeah.
But after the work I'd done on Captorhinids, I wanted to understand, how do you make this kind of complex dentition from sort of your standard dinosaur dentition? And in that process, learned a lot about about dental batteries and how weird they are. And just to give you an example, when we started cutting them open to look at these things in more detail, the internal anatomy, the histology, one of the things that popped out to me right away that blew me away is that when you look at these dental batteries, they look like they're one big coalesced mass of teeth fused together. The weirdest thing is when you section them, not a single one of those teeth is physically touching the other one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Instead, what's holding that battery together is the matrix that those dinosaurs were buried in.
Huh.
Yeah. Sand, mud, grit. And so what that means is that a soft tissue that was there has decayed and been replaced by sediment, usually, or mineral infilling, depending on the case. That I did not expect that.
Yeah.
Because you'd think it would make sense to have a nice fused chunk of made of teeth to act as a single grinding surface.
Yeah.
Instead, what they had and we can be fairly certain of this, is they had a system of ligaments that was holding each individual tooth.
That's a lot of ligaments.
To its neighbor. I know. It sounds crazy and more complicated than it needs to be.
Yeah.
But I kid you not. Like you section these things open, and it's hard to section a hadrosaur dental battery because they're really big.
Yeah.
We've done it a few times now. And, you know, we can replicate this. We can show you. None of the teeth are touching each other.
Hmm.
And so that sort of led me to look at a sort of a more standard dinosaur dentition. And that's actually something you found almost universally across dinosaurs.
Yeah.
There's a ligament system.
Yeah.
Like in mammals, like in crocs, that holds their teeth in place.
Yeah.
And so hadrosaurs had this. So that's kind of cool. And it's probably this ligament system that allows them to constantly add new teeth at the bottom of the battery and have this thing constantly erupt or move towards the surface where they're grinding the teeth down.
Do they still have like sockets at the bottom for the initial teeth, or how does that kind of work?
Sort of. each stack sits in its own little groove.
Okay.
Made by socket bone.
Oh, yeah. And actually, now that I think of a hadrosaur dentition.
Yeah. And a lot of this starts to make intuitive sense when you think about, like, you can find hadrosaur jaws without the batteries, right? Yeah. And you can see the grooves.
Yeah, you can see little.
Yeah. And that's because, again, the soft tissue has decayed.
So the teeth fall out.
They will fall out.
Interesting.
And even crazier is that battery can then fall apart.
Huh.
So you might have one dental battery from one animal, but it can disintegrate into 200, 300 teeth.
Yeah.
And what we noticed in doing the thin section work was that as the teeth reach the surface of the battery, where they're going to be grinding the plant material, each individual tooth completely fills up with dentine.
Hmm.
And dentine is that tube-filled tissue that we have in our teeth too. It's the tissue that gives our teeth its sensitivity to hot and cold, like I said. It's produced by cells inside the tooth in a part called the pulp.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is that pulp completely infills with dentine.
Hmm.
And we argue that essentially, the tooth essentially kills itself because the vital part of the tooth is in the pulp.
Yeah.
And that completely fills in with this dentine. And it's a fairly hard tissue. It's about the same hardness as bone, maybe a bit harder. And by the time the teeth reach the surface, they're a solid block of dentine inside. So they have enamel on one side of their teeth.
Yeah.
And then there's a solid block of dentine. And that allows them to grind the entire tooth down.
Uh-huh.
No pain or sensitivity there because it's completely a solid block of tissue.
Yeah.
And they'll grind the whole thing down. We had sections where all you could see was a little nubbin left over of the tip of a root of one of the teeth along the battery. And so that kind of led us to some interesting conclusions is that, well, they didn't actually shed their teeth.
Yeah.
Like you and I do. We lose our baby teeth.
Yeah.
Right? Because the adult ones come in and eat away at the root of the baby teeth. And then the top part of our baby teeth falls out.
Yeah.
That didn't happen in hadrosaurs. They ground them down.
I know you can sometimes find like hadrosaur teeth in the fossil record. So if you find a single tooth, that means it's one that's fallen out of a battery after it died rather than it being shed. Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if we're finding little nubbins of roots still attached to the battery that they're grinding down, that tells you, if you find a quote unquote shed tooth in the field of a hadrosaur, odds are that was part of a battery that fell apart.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And how did ceratopsians compare to that? Because they also have a battery, but it's slightly different.
Yeah. They have a battery too. They have a vertical stack of teeth as well. Not as many as some of the more complex hadrosaur dental batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when sectioning a battery, I mean, you're dealing with a dinosaur, so you're dealing with a giant animal. I had access to one Triceratops dentary battery to section, and it was an absolute nightmare to section this thing, but I'm so glad I did because it was really interesting because ceratopsian dinosaurs, at least from what I've seen, their teeth don't seem to infill that pulp with dentine the way that hadrosaurs do. And so there's a lot of unanswered questions still in my mind about, okay, well, and as the teeth reach the surface and then start to be sheared down, ground down through tooth wear, what happens to that tooth then? I mean, it's not a solid block like the hadrosaurs. We noticed a lot of cool things. Like if you, when you look deep down in a triceratops dental battery, the new teeth actually start to eat away at the ones above them.
Interesting.
Which is fairly normal. That happens in most reptiles, as the new teeth start to eat away at the bases of the old ones.
Yeah.
But they actually invade the pulp chamber of the older tooth above them. And then they sort of tuck into that pulp chamber, forming sort of like a cone inside a cone arrangement for their battery, which is actually very different from what hadrosaurs do. Because by the time new teeth are starting to move up the battery in hadrosaurs, it's the older ones are already infilled completely. So there's something different going on there.
Yeah. Does that mean that they had, like, were their teeth actually touching, unlike the kind of ligament system with hadrosaurs?
I know. It would sound like they do, but they don't. I know. So we sectioned those ones too. And lo and behold, none of the teeth are physically touching each other again. Instead, actually, in our Triceratops example, our battery was a bit more crushed.
Yeah.
That we had to work with, which, you know, it doesn't make it as pretty of a thin section to look at. But the histological detail, the tissue level detail was so good in this Triceratops battery that I could look at the surfaces of the teeth and see where the ligament would actually attach to. Mm-hmm. It leaves behind these mineralized ends of these fibers, these collagen fibers act like the tiny bridge cables that suspend each tooth in the socket. They leave behind those markings in the tooth root, and you can see them beautifully in the Triceratops. You can see them, and then you in one tooth at the in the root of one tooth, and then you'll see a sediment gap, and then you'll see the tooth beside it, which also has these anchoring points for this ligament, and you can almost draw the line across that gap and say, oh, this is where the ligament attaches. So absolutely, they had the same ligament system that hadrosaurs do. I should point out, we've identified that same ligament system in theropod dinosaurs.
Interesting.
It's probably a shared primitive feature of dinosaurs. And they just sort of play with that arrangement of tissues to create novel dentitions.
Do sauropods have that? Thinking of other herbivorous dinosaurs.
Yeah, do sauropods have it? They absolutely do. And there's some good histological work. And oh, geez, I'm blanking on the names right now of the researchers that showed this. But it was sort of a eureka moment for me, because it sort of came out. I remember it coming out at the same time that I was starting to work on dinosaurs. And they actually used our didactyd study and said, oh, we're actually finding the same tissues that you see in diadectids. We're finding them here, the same tissues you see in crocodilians. This must be this ligament that holds the teeth in place.
Interesting.
They were looking at a lot of work done by my current postdoc advisor, Mike Caldwell. He found the same things in mosasaurs, these giant marine lizards. So we were starting to all connect the dots independently that this ligament system is quite conserved in reptiles and also found in mammals.
Interesting. In terms of a dental battery, are there modern animals that do kind of similar things?
That's a very good question. So mammals can't do that kind of dental battery thing where they have hundreds of teeth that coalesce together.
Yeah.
And they can't, because mammals don't replace their teeth constantly throughout their lives like a reptile does. So reptiles take advantage of this thing called polyphyodonty, this idea of constantly making new teeth to replace old ones. Mammals have lost that ability.
Yeah.
So mammals have come up with different ways of addressing the problem of tooth wear, especially in herbivores. So again, the horse example is a good one. Instead of having a dental battery, they'll have really complicated, high-crowned teeth, but they're not going to have a whole bunch of teeth. They'll have sort of the standard complement of mammal teeth. Elephants, they do something similar. Instead of having, you know, a huge complex dental battery, lots of teeth, they actually have like really giant and complicated teeth, but you know, they sort of bring in one at a time to grind down and kind of bring them forward as they're grinding down their teeth. But it's not like they have hundreds of them.
Is that the same kind of thing that like mammoths do? Because I can think of what a mammoth tooth looks like.
Yep. And yeah, you think of how complicated a mammoth tooth is. Like if you run your hand in a museum exhibit across a mammoth tooth, it's like a, what do they call it? Like a corrugated, a rough surface full of ridges and valleys. Yeah, that the way they do that is by rearranging those same tissues that make up a tooth that you see in you and I.
Yeah.
The same ones. It's just just
in different.
Exactly. It's sort of like origami. You're folding things into different patterns, making it more complicated. Yeah. And as it's worn down, it's revealing a complicated surface that gets worn down.
Interesting. I guess we talked about kind of initially diadectids and then captorhinids, which are very complicated, and then getting up to the dinosaurs. So is there no kind of evolutionary pathway that you can say for dentition in herbivores? Or is there a lot of some groups do this and then kind of all over the place?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that sort of comes back to the bad joke I made, which is I'm sort of, like I said, a jack of all clades. So I've looked at a lot of these different groups.
Yeah.
I haven't spent a lot of time intensively studying all these individual groups. So instead, what I can comment on is sort of the things that they have in common in these different herbivorous groups that have independently evolved, you know, complicated dentitions.
Yeah.
As we've said, a lot of the times to deal with herbivory.
Yeah.
Because that's a pretty big challenge for animals. I would say that there are a couple patterns that have come across. It's not like there's rules that I've identified, but I would say one of the big patterns for reptiles is to either evolve a more complicated tooth, like in diadectids, to have they have sort of these cusps and low points on their teeth to help create a more complicated surface.
Yeah.
You see the same thing in mammals. They have more complicated individual teeth. But for dental batteries, that's a whole different class of changes to the dentition. I call dentition level changes. And those are things like overcoming normal tooth replacement.
Mm.
So instead of replacing an old tooth with a new one, most reptiles that have a dental battery, they place the new teeth in a different spot than where the old ones are. So a good example would be that multiple tooth rows of captorhinids.
Mm-hmm.
New teeth are added on the inside rows, and they sort of gradually migrate across the jaw to the outside, while they're always adding new ones on the inside. So they're moving them away from the site where new ones are being added.
Yeah.
And you could find a parallel in things like hadrosaurs. New teeth are added at the bases of these batteries, and as the teeth are constantly moving up towards the chewing or the grinding surface, you know, they're moving away from the site where new ones are being added. So they can just keep adding them to this structure.
Interesting.
So that and that can take a lot of evolutionary changes. I mean, think of captorhinids. They have to change the way their jawbones grow.
Yeah.
Which is, that's incredible that they did that. And two different groups did that. And then the same thing with hadrosaurs, to co-opt this system of ligaments that they had into this constantly moving structure, because that's really what it is. It's constantly, these teeth are constantly moving towards the grinding surface. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really interesting. Are there any trends that you can see between kind of changes in dentition and changes in the plants that are around at a time, or any kind of relationship there?
That's a really good question. I have not looked into that.
Yeah, I just thought about it.
Yeah. No, that is a good question, because a good example, and I apologize to the people that specialize in this if I butcher it, but in grassland environments, I mean, you have very, very tough plants that animals have a big challenge, you know, grinding up and then physically digesting and then chemically digesting. And that leads to a lot of tooth wear.
Yeah.
I don't know about in the case of softer plants from, you know, let's say, I have no idea what diadectids we're eating, to be honest with you, or captorhinids for that matter.
Mm.
We lump them into this idea that they were called high fiber herbivores.
Mm-hmm.
So they're eating tough fibrous stuff, we assume is plants. But we don't know how tough relative to other things. So really, That would be a really cool study if we could integrate sort of paleobotany in with that and to look at more some of the more direct observations in fossils where we're more certain about the kinds of plants certain animals were eating.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets into some really complicated stuff, though, because correlating tooth shape to diet, you know, is very hard.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a paper that came out, I think, last year that suggested that hadrosaurs were also partaking in a diet of crabs every now and then, or crustaceans, you know?
Oh, I think I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, why not? I don't know. But, you know, I was just reading the other day about a species of bamboo shark, I think modern species of bamboo shark. They'll eat soft fish, and they'll also eat hard-shelled crabs.
Hmm.
And the teeth don't look like crushing teeth or anything like that.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get that from their teeth.
Yeah.
So it would take a special data set to look at that.
I can see that it would be difficult, but it would be really interesting to see if there are any trends with, as you change from some type of vegetation to another over time, do you also see a similar change in dentition?
Yeah, that would be very cool.
Yeah.
The mammal literature, I'm sure, has gone through this a bit. I think with reptiles, that would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Especially in the Paleozoic era, because that's when you see those pioneering herbivorous tetrapods that are, and are they eating the same kinds of plants?
Yeah.
And how does that change, you know, as plants, land plants are evolving and herbivores are sort of, I guess, keeping up in a sense and exploiting that resource. I mean, do they change their dentitions? Do they become more complicated? I don't know.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Are there kind of similar studies you could do with carnivores looking at that? Or is that something that people have done before?
Yeah. So it's funny. I thought after my master's, I'd become a bit of a paleo hipster and not work on dinosaurs, especially theropods. And that's
what
actually
you're doing now.
Well, I ended up doing some of that. But again, it was really interesting to me because I had looked at hadrosaurs and how complicated they were, and I wanted to know what other dinosaurs were doing.
Yeah.
And through that, I got to work a lot with Dr. Kirsten Brink.
Yeah.
She was in Robert Rice's lab at this around the same time as I was, and we worked together a lot. And through our work together and through a lot of her work for her thesis, we learned a lot about carnivorous things like Dimetrodon, that sailback early synapse, an early ancestor of ours. Mm-hmm. Not a dinosaur.
Not a dinosaur.
We learned a lot about how they evolved tooth serrations.
Yeah.
How they evolved this great adaptation for tearing through tough meat. You know, we know theropod dinosaurs have tooth serrations. But Kirsten was able to look at some of the earliest relatives of Dimetrodon and Dimetrodon itself in these different species and tracked how tooth serrations evolved in that group.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting. So you see sort of this directional trend, I'll say, towards progressively more complicated cutting edges in Dimetrodon.
Interesting.
And then we also looked at the serrations in theropod dinosaurs. And a lot of that was Kirsten being very precise with a thin sectioning saw. Like, can you imagine cutting the cutting edge of a theropod tooth? I mean, that's like a measure nine times, cut once kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to look at sort of some of the adaptations for their teeth for dissipating the stresses of cutting through tough meat and things.
Interesting.
So there's lots to look at.
Yeah. What do you think is kind of the next big question? Are you sort of continuing on with the same research right now, or are you kind of you're not moving away from teeth, are you?
Oh, I don't want to move away from teeth right now. I like studying teeth. They've been good to me. It's sort of going in two directions right now for me.
Yeah.
I'm starting to move backwards. So phylogenetically away from reptiles, from my postdoc projects here at the University of Alberta, I've been really interested in fish dentitions, looking at sharks because of course we know they have a conveyor belt like arrangement where new teeth sort of rotate into position as they're falling out of the mouth. So studying sharks has become very interesting for me, how a lot of these complex dentitions work. But I'm also still continuing on that trek of also just documenting tooth complexity and how teeth interact with the jawbones to create novel kinds of dentitions. In the Caldwell lab here, we also recently worked on mosasaur teeth.
Yeah.
And that's something near and dear to my heart. I worked on mosasaurs for my master's. It's also near and dear to Mike's heart because he's a lizard guy and he works a lot on mosasaurs. And we also looked at snakes in that example and showed similarities in how snake teeth develop and attach to the jaws, as well as in mosasaurs. And so I have a lot of questions about teeth. And so when I get the chance to work on them, I sort of jump at the occasion. I think one of the projects that's still a holdover from my PhD thesis that I'm still working on and really want to keep working on is the evolution of the mammalian tooth system. So we have, again, that ligament system in our teeth. I want to understand what selective forces and sort of when, evolutionarily speaking, the stereotypical mammal tooth evolved in terms of the tissues.
Yeah.
Because a lot of animals fuse their teeth to the jaws, like I said. A lot of them don't.
Yeah.
And I want to understand on the mammalian lineage side, when does that happen?
Yeah.
And why does it happen? And so there's a lot of work I'm trying to do there still.
Very interesting. Well, thank you for talking with me, Aaron.
Well, thanks for coming. It was fun.
Good.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/PaleoCast to get all the latest news.